are listening to CFRC 101.9 FM. This is CFRC Prison Radio, a weekly show about prison issues. We have a lot of content tonight, so I'm not going to talk much, but I will leave the contact information for you. So you can get in touch with us at CFRC Prison Radio at riseup.net. You can write us at CPR, care of CFRC, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, Kilo 7 Lima, 3 November 6. And you can give us a call. We do a monthly show called Calls from Home, where we play song requests, messages, love letters, all kinds of stuff from people on the outside to people in prison. So you can give us a call, 613-329-2698. Tonight's show, we're taking a look at youth detention. Youth detention is an often overlooked component of the Canadian prison industrial complex. Generally speaking, under Ontario law, anyone under 18 convicted of crimes cannot be publicly identified. And while this is probably a good protection, it means that unless you know a young person who has become quote-unquote in conflict with the law, the public generally has no idea how the system works or what's going on inside youth detention facilities. So to find out more, we did arrange an interview with Diane Irwin, who is Executive Director of the St. Lawrence Youth Association. The St. Lawrence Youth Association operates two juvenile detention facilities in the Kingston area. Achievement St. Lawrence is in North Kingston. It's basically a remand facility for boys. And Sundance, which is a high security closed facility for girls aged 12 to 17. I interviewed Diane about the organization with the intention of trying to get a better picture of how it operates. And I would like to say we did reach out to some of our contacts locally to speak with somebody who's been incarcerated in one of these facilities, but for understandable reasons, we have so far been unsuccessful. If you know someone who would like to share their story with us, we are interested in that, and we encourage you to get in touch with us. So we'll be back after this interview with Diane Irwin. Would you be able to give our listeners an overview of the St. Lawrence Youth Association in terms of its mandate?
We serve youth in conflict with the law at all kinds of different levels, and we are funded by the Ministry of Children and Youth Services as a transfer payment agency to provide those services. They are the only funder that we have. We work with youth to decrease the criminogenic need and try to decrease reoffending behavior.
You came into existence in 1974. Mm-hmm. So before 1974, if a youth is brought before a criminal justice system, what happens?
To be honest, I can't really give you too much information about that, but I do know the way St. Lawrence Youth became established was because there was a judge in Kingston, as well as a program at St. Lawrence Youth, or St. Lawrence College, sorry, the BST program. They were talking together many times, concerned about the way youth were treated in the criminal or in the youth justice system. There wasn't really a lot of consideration about the fact of their age, as well as their histories and certain things that they've been through. They created initially a boys' group home, and then they thought they would piggyback onto that by having a period of observation for youth if they had come in conflict with the law, so that there could be a period of assessment to see maybe consideration of what their histories were, so if there had been abuse in their life or neglect or, you know, certain maybe some mental health components to it. So having that assessment period prior to them going to court so that some recommendations and considerations could be made. They initially pretty much staffed the observation home with, it was detention observation, with students from the BST program, supervised by, you know, that professor. So that was kind of the beginning of it, and then they determined that the group home youth didn't really mesh very well with the youth in the detention observation, so they ended up separating them out. So that was the beginning of it. And then a few years later, they ended up with an overflow situation. So St. Lawrence acquired Shaw House, which is actually right next door to here. It's 845 Division Street. It was also used as open detention and custody. Eventually, Sundance was built, and that is for secure detention and custody for females. At the time, it was co-ed, but currently, our secure setting is females only, and our open detention custody is for males.
Okay, and could you explain the difference between open and secure custody?
The placement is determined by the level of crime. So more serious crimes would be secure, and certain other things, like even if the youth's criteria didn't only met open, but then they ran from an open facility, they could potentially be having to stay in secure. Generally speaking, the youth in secure, they either have much more serious crimes or they have serious crimes and many of them. The youth that we get now in secure are generally much more entrenched in the system than they used to be. We find that. We also find that the youth we're getting are very high needs, particularly in mental health. So open, it'd be lesser crimes, and they do have the potential to have more community interaction while they're staying with us. There are times where a youth might even attend a community school, and there's more opportunities for community work, so community service hours or that type of thing, more engagement with the community, where secure, they're very limited in their ability to be outside of the facility. We also serve youth in the community, so we have youth that have never been in any facility, but they're on probation. And a probation officer may refer them to our community support team to work on those criminogenic factors to hopefully keep them out of a facility and decrease reoffending behavior. So our other community programs, just so you're aware too, we have a intensive support and supervision program, which our workers are master's level therapists and psychotherapists, and they work with youth who have severe mental health issues that have been diagnosed, and a court has ordered them to complete this program. They would otherwise be in a custody situation. But again, looking at the mitigating factors and the fact that, you know, they have these mental health issues, they're better served in the community. So some of those youth could be with our workers for up to 3 years. And then we have a youth justice family worker, which is a new position. And those families are referred by youth diversion. So youth diversion might be working with a client, and then there's a lot of family conflict going on. So they will refer the family to our worker. And then so we're both teaming up to work with the entire family that way.
Is a goal of your organization to prevent youth from becoming criminalized as an adult and staying in that system?
Yes.
So in what ways do you try to steer them away from that?
We initially, they come to us and we do an assessment, and the assessment identifies the criminogenic factors and the levels of each of those factors. So we would be targeting the highest factor. We first of all expose them to other ideas. Oftentimes the youth don't really have the capacity, they've not experienced certain things before. Leisure is a big thing, a big risk area. So they may not have had any opportunities for positive leisure activities in their life. So we would then try to expose them to opportunities that they could have and continue with that are realistic. And so sometimes, you know, that in itself is a way to decrease criminal behavior. They never realize that it's more normal for kids to do these other activities than it is for them to be hanging out in a park you know, smoking weed or whatever. It's a lot of education, psychoeducation type of thing, a lot of family work, because it's not usually just the youth that's the problem.
Do you work with the Children's AIDS Society as well? Is that often a link that you find in those cases?
Yeah, many of our youth have CAS backgrounds, yeah. Yeah, especially in our facilities.
If you're a boy and you are sentenced to secure custody, is it Cobourg generally that they go to?
There's Cobourg, there's also Ottawa. So it depends on where the youth is from.
And so most of the youth you have are from this area?
Our open covers Napanee to Leeds and Grenville. Our secure covers a much broader area. We cover from Oshawa to Cornwall.
Okay, just because there's fewer of those facilities?
Yeah,
okay.
Fewer for girls especially.
Right.
Yeah, there's fewer females in the system.
There's only like less than 10 girls in there at any one time, generally.
Yes. In my opinion, the smaller facilities are much easier to manage. The higher the numbers, the more the difficulties, the more the dynamics, as far as the groupings and the cliques and, you know, all those types of things. I've worked in larger facilities, and it's a much more difficult situation to manage.
How did you come to this position, and what's your kind of background in this?
Well, initially I was a nurse and decided to change career directions. I moved to the States thinking I was going to work as a nurse there, but I didn't like the system down there. I was uncomfortable ethically with it. So I'd always been interested in psychology, so I went to a university there and got a master's in mental health counseling. And just by chance, I ended up going to a job fair and ended up working with high-risk girls in a residential program, and didn't think that was going to be my cup of tea, but I loved it. So I worked as a therapist for a few years with girls in high risk, and then I worked with males. I've worked in intensive mental health as well, and ended up becoming clinical director at a facility that was intensive mental health for males and females. We had, I guess it was 120 youth in our facility, so very large, and there was always, you know, crisis in that type of environment. I was originally from Kingston, grew up here, and wanted to return home, so I was looking for a job and decided to apply for the job at St. Lawrence Youth Association as their clinician. Got that job and then ended up becoming the director of residential services, and then ended up as the executive director. Yeah, it was quite different coming to the Canadian system, having been in the U.S. system. Just the sheer numbers of youth that are incarcerated is phenomenal in the States. The length of the stays, most of our youth, well, in a high-risk program, they would probably be in for at least 3 years. And even in a moderate risk program, they would probably be in for a year to 18 months. It has some advantages, only that you get more time to work with them, but the disadvantages far outweigh. The advantages, I mean, they become institutionalized and they're away from their families for a significant period of time, and they're exposed to a lot of negative things from other, you know, other youth that are in there that have more significant issues. So I was very happy and pleasantly surprised when I came to Canada to see that this facilities are much smaller, they're much more manageable. There's not a lot of peer-on-peer violence, which in the States is you're almost unable to control that because of the numbers and the staffing ratios.
I mean, presumably you do have some incidents in these facilities. How do you respond to that, like in terms of staff? How are they trained to respond to those kinds of incidents?
We do train our staff in PMAB. It's Prevention and Management of Aggressive Behavior. Mm-hmm. So the first level of that is de-escalation. if a youth becomes unmanageable, our staff would restrain, and that is generally when an assault would happen. A youth is going to fight back, generally speaking. A PMAB requires two staff to restrain a youth, but there are, you know, sometimes during the restraint, the youth is able, or, you know, they do lash out, so they might kick somebody, they might hit somebody, they might spit at somebody, they could bite somebody. And those are all situations that happen. But we always ask our staff, you know, after the fact, if they would like to charge the youth. And our staff generally decline, unless it's something that has been very serious and or very intentional and planned. You know, that, but those are very rare, I can tell you. The only thing they're allowed to do is restraining. There is no mechanical devices of any type. There's no protective gear. We don't use batons. I know there's people that think we do.
What kind of contact does somebody have with their family or their community in Sundance specifically? So, or do people make phone calls? Is there mail? Like,
youth have right to as much mail as they want, and they can send and receive as much mail as they want. Mm-hmm. We don't have a restricted visiting time. We allow families to come when they can. Mm-hmm. They get phone calls at certain times of the day. Youth are in school during the day. There's teachers in both facilities. So we have a structure to the day, and a lot of the big chunk of that is school.
And if somebody, because you mentioned that you try to separate somebody from a context that maybe is negative for them. So if they have a friend who is seen as a bad influence or something, mm-hmm. would they be allowed to write a letter to that person or discouraged from doing so? How does that work?
The probation officer is pretty much in charge of deciding who the youth will contact and who they won't contact. And then we receive that information, and then we have that documented so that we're all aware. Sometimes they have a non-association order from the court, and so we are not allowed to let them associate with that person. Mm-hmm. And we'll find out who that person is and deflect, you know, things that might come that way.
What is the provincial advocate for children and youth? Are they, like, I understand they're kind of like an oversight body or a government regulatory body?
Yeah.
So how does that relate to your organization?
They monitor systems that work with youth, and their mandate is to make sure that youth are safe, and in any situation, especially in residential care, that they're not exposed to any sort of negative treatment.
How often do they visit? How often do you engage with that body?
We have had them visit us. Our youth have a right to call the advocate's office whenever they want to. And so if they believe they have been mistreated in any way, they can call the advocate's office. So if there's multiple complaints coming from a particular youth, we might get a visit. We haven't had a visit from the advocate's office in quite some time, but sometimes they'll come for a tour. When a youth calls the advocate's office, the advocate will immediately follow up with us, either phone call or email, and they will require an explanation of the situation. So if the explanation seems reasonable, that's the end of it. If it doesn't seem reasonable, there might be more investigation into it.
In 2014, they produced a report across the whole province about secure isolation in youth facilities in Ontario. Do you use secure isolation in your facilities, and how do you use it?
We do use secure isolation. It's the least, you want to use the least intrusive method to control behavior if things are escalating. So it's when a youth becomes very assaultive and aggressive toward others that is the issue. The only other situation that you're allowed to use secure isolation by standard is if there's significant property damage. If a youth goes into secure isolation, they would go in, and while they're in there, our staff have eyes on them at all times, and they're always talking to the youth. They're trying to re-engage them. They're trying to calm them down. you know, and then once the youth is calm, then they develop a release plan. So the youth and the staff are very clear as to what's going to happen when the door opens, that the youth is no longer, you know, going to be aggressive toward people. An hour is usually as much as it takes for a youth to calm down. There are exceptions to that, but very rare exceptions.
Have you ever had to deal with like a disturbance at a facility where you had to call the police?
Not in my time at Sundance, we haven't. We have had to call at the open facility, though. The open facility has less, there's less staffing there. So there's only two staff on shift. And if something gets out of control, they just don't have the ability to handle it. There's no such thing as secure isolation in open.
Right.
So we do require police sometimes to come in and maybe take control of a situation. In the event that a youth causes a significant disturbance or is extremely aggressive in an open situation, most often they're going to be then transferred to a secure facility.
In what direction would you like to see youth justice and the system in general move in the future?
Well, we have a lot of ideas, like just as far as our own agency goes, but so does the ministry as well. And one of the really great things about the system is that custody numbers have decreased significantly in the system. The numbers of youth in general in that age group has decreased in our population, but that doesn't account for the numbers, the decrease in the custody. There's a lot of other programs going on right now to address, just as an example, youth that have a lot of aggression or acting out behavior when they're young, you know, like eight. I'm talking about 8 years old type of thing. So definitely more on the early side of things still. I think we would like to see more of that. We would really love to see more support for youth when they exit our system. As far as housing goes, that's a huge, huge issue. Very difficult to get into the typical shelter situation or transition housing situation because of charges, because of potential behavior, because they've had it in the past. People are worried, you know. Our view is that if they were given an opportunity to have supportive housing with staff who knew how to manage that behavior, that is what's missing. Our most challenging situation every day is finding appropriate or making appropriate discharge plans for our youth.
You've been listening to an interview with Diane Irwin, who's the executive director of the St. Lawrence Youth Association, about youth incarceration in the Kingston area. As we were researching this issue to prepare for our interview, we came across a class action lawsuit that has been launched against Ontario and all third-party operators of youth detention facilities, including the St. Lawrence Youth Association. The lawsuit alleges that holding youth in solitary confinement is negligent and breaches the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. I reached out and spoke with Scott Robinson, who is an associate lawyer with Kosky Minsky in Toronto, about the case.
My name is Scott Robinson. I'm an associate lawyer at the law firm of Kosky Minsky in Toronto, and a significant department of our firm does strictly plaintiff side class action litigation. A majority of our cases kind of have a social justice bent, including a significant practice against Crown actors, be it Canada, Ontario, or other provinces.
And you're working on it's called the Youth Confinement Class Action, correct?
It's a pre-certification class action, so it's a proposed class proceeding. We started the case in fall of 2015, and we've been proceeding ever since. And it alleges breach of fiduciary duty, negligence, and breaches of various sections of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms against Ontario on account of the placement of youths in, we would call it solitary confinement, in youth justice facilities in Ontario. Our claim captures 23 of those facilities.
Okay, so can you break down that terminology a bit in terms of solitary confinement versus secure isolation versus administrative segregation? Why do we have so many different terms for essentially the same thing?
You know, solitary confinement, I would say, is small s, small c, solitary confinement. The secure isolation is capital S, capital I, secure isolation. Administrative segregation is used in the federal context. You know, these are just terms that are taken from the various acts or regulations to those acts.
This followed a report by the Provincial Advocate for Children and Youth that saw pretty high levels of long-term use of secure isolation in these facilities, right?
Our firm has been following, you know, it's undeniable in the last, you know, 10 years, certainly the last 5 years, there's been a very clear trend against the use of solitary confinement, not only in Canadian prisons, but, you know, the world over, right? So our firm has been following that quite closely and acting accordingly. You know, for example, we have another proposed class proceeding on the go right now against Canada on account of the use of, I'm going to call it solitary confinement, against prisoners with mental illnesses, right? Another vulnerable population. And so it's something that we've been looking at for quite some time and been monitoring it. And, you know, the sentiments against the use of solitary confinement has only been growing in recent years. You know, in 2012, the Ontario Auditor General released a report that was highlighting the improper use of solitary confinement in many of the Ontario youth justice facilities. In 2013, the Provincial Advocate for Children and Youth released a report particularly targeting the Roy McMurtry Youth Centre. And then last year was really it's a report from the Advocate for Children and Youth titled It's a Matter of Time, which was a systemic review of secure isolation in Ontario youth justice facilities. That really, really put the microscope on the use of this practice in Ontario youth justice facilities. When that report was launched, that could be seen as, you know, the final tipping point that caused us to launch this case. It's a very, very topical issue, very serious issue, and I think an issue that the public needs to be more aware about.
And do you think this started in Canada with the Ashley Smith inquest? Is that where this current sort of wave of backlash has come from?
I don't know if it started there. That certainly put it on the front page of the newspapers, that's for sure. But I do think, you know, that various public interest organizations have been speaking out against this in Canada and internationally for quite some time, right? You look at the Canadian Medical Association has had a comment on this. The United Nations certainly have what they purport to be rules with respect to the use of solitary confinement on youth.
Are you hoping to see the practice abolished in youth facilities altogether?
You know, I don't want to speak too much about what the expectations of the case are. It's still very early in the case, so I want to be careful on that point. There certainly is a problem with the way that Ontario is administering it right now. You know, the UN, for example, calls for a complete abolition of it. Our case is framed more against Ontario for the negligent systemic operation of the system.
There's laws in Ontario that protect the identities of youth who get involved in that system. So have you found it difficult to actually find plaintiffs?
It hasn't been the easiest case to find other people that have been harmed in a common way. They certainly are out there. But the way that Ontario class proceedings work and most class proceeding regimes throughout Canada work is it's called an opt-out regime as opposed to an opt-in. If that is certified, then anyone who meets that class definition is, by default, captured by the class action. So you don't need to sign up, per se. There's a notice regime that goes out, and people can then opt out of the class action if they want. But basically, the default is inclusion as opposed to exclusion in Ontario class actions, and that certainly assists us procedurally in a case like this.
Are you able to speak to why the UN recommends not using solitary confinement on youth?
I'm not able to give, you know, specific reasons for why that is the case. That is, you know, that happens to be one of the various groups that have given their opinion on it. Generally, you could probably see a complete prohibition from the UN on the use of solitary confinement on A, mentally ill prisoners, and then B, those effectively any person under the age of 18. That's kind of the way that the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture has given that opinion. But other groups, if they haven't taken a complete prohibition, they've certainly given their opinion to curb the use thereof.
Right, yeah, we've seen the John Howard Society come out, the BC Civil Liberties Association.
Yeah, the Canadian Medical Association, for example, has been quite clear that it'll certainly, in their view, contribute to further anxiety, depression, anger being instilled in the youth. And the youth population is going to be inherently vulnerable just given their age and this stage of development, right? So or solitary confinement may have, you know, X amount of effect on a fully grown person, let's say, right? Both physical and mental effect. Well, it's pretty clear that that effect is going to be only exacerbated on a youth, and especially in their formative period, right?
So this seems to be sort of all across the board a pretty a major shift seems to be happening.
You know, you check any newspaper almost every day, there seems to be something new about it. If not in Canada, then on the international level. So there does undeniably, outside of the courts, yeah, you know, let's just say even on a social level, there does seem to be an undeniable trend against the use of this practice. If a particular organization doesn't advocate for complete abolition or prohibition, they certainly advocate for a change to the way that it is administered, that's for sure. This is, as I said earlier, this is an incredibly important and topical case, in our view. This is in keeping with, as we said, a clear trend both domestically and internationally for some changes to the way that this practice is administered.
You've been listening to an interview with Scott Robinson of Kosky-Minsk. Minsky about the youth confinement class action lawsuit. To find out more, especially if you might be someone who would fall under that class action lawsuit, visit kilomlaw.ca, that's kmlaw.ca, and look up the youth confinement class action lawsuit. You can email them at youthconfinementclassaction@kmlaw.ca. They also have a toll-free hotline you can call at 1-844-819-8501. We'll also link that on our website, which is cfrcprisonradio.wordpress.com. We'll be right back after some music.
Spend some time, I hear it's fine. Spend some time, I hear it's fine.
Spend Some Time by Immortal Technique off the Revolutionary Volume 1 album. Good album. So for the second half of our show, we are going to syndicate an interview. It's actually from 9 years ago, so this is kind of unusual. But we wanted something that was a little bit more critical to complement our other pieces on youth detention that we're covering tonight on CFRC Prison Radio. So this is a piece from Stark Raven Radio in Vancouver. It was aired on December 10th, 2007. It's with Annabelle Webb from an organization that still exists called Justice for Girls. And she spoke about being barred from the Burnaby Youth Jail after bringing up allegations of sexual abuse by medical doctors at the facility. She also gives a sort of general overview of the youth detention system in Vancouver and her thoughts on it. I think it's really good. And we thank Stark Raven 9 years ago for providing this content to us.
Young people locked up in prison in the Lower Mainland found themselves with new surroundings this past October. They were moved from the 1950s youth jail near BCIT in Burnaby into what used to be the Burnaby Correctional Center for Women in the far corners of southeast Burnaby. To find out what's happening in this new prison, we called up Justice for Girls, a local advocacy group works with young women living in poverty. And they've heard several stories but haven't been able to go inside the new prison. This is because they were barred in the summer after they brought forward allegations of sexual abuse by a medical doctor during breast exams for young women at the jail. Annabelle Webb works with Justice for Girls, and she joins us in the studio to tell us more about what's going on with the youth prison system. Thanks for joining us and coming down, Annabelle.
Thanks very much for having me.
So can you start by telling us this story about what led you to get barred from the prison?
Sure. It all started back in about June when we went into the prison, as we do on a regular basis, to talk to young women about their rights within the criminal justice system, so across the board, sort of from policing to prison, what their rights are. And we asked the young women there kind of a simple question about whether there was anything that they felt uncomfortable with during forensic psychiatric assessments. So assessments that are done within the prison that are court-ordered for the purpose of sentencing. And what the young women disclosed to us during that session was that as part of youth forensic psychiatric assessments, they were being given breast examinations and gynecological examinations. So you can imagine the shock of hearing this for us. And the other thing that they disclosed during that session was that there was a specific sexual abuse allegation against one of the doctors who was working there. So a male doctor had performed a breast examination on a 13-year-old girl who was court-ordered for psychiatric assessment. So we began to do the advocacy around those allegations and around generally the fact that as sort of general procedure they were conducting breast and gynecological examinations on girls during forensic assessments.
So you've been going to this youth prison for a few years now.
Yeah, for about 5 years we've been out there, and we've dealt with all kinds of situations. Obviously, there are numerous human rights abuses going on in the prison out there. This one was the reaction to our advocacy, I have to say, has been bizarre and quite astounding, really. The prison responded to us as advocates by kicking us out of the prison and came up with, you know, a number of accusations against us and to justify them kicking us out of the prison. But essentially what they did was, when we brought the abuse allegations forward and when we questioned this practice, which we consider to be sexually abusive, to subject girls to breast and gynecological examinations in that context, we consider to be abusive, they effectively barred us from doing any further advocacy with the girls and cut us off from the girls who were in the prison and in the midst of you know, going through a sexual abuse investigation.
So have these sorts of forensic psychiatric examinations, which sound a bit stressful in the first place, mm-hmm. are those new, or has this always been going on and this is the first time that you'd heard of like this gynecological addition to the exam?
Well, it's been really hard to get information. What we do know, and what the Ministry of Children and Families is saying, because they're actually the authority that runs the prison, which many people don't realize. So the Child Welfare Agency is actually running the prison. So it puts them, in my opinion, in a real conflict of interest when we're bringing forward abuse allegations that are going on under their roof. But what they've told us, when we question this policy or this procedure around, first of all, what you should know is that we've checked with family practice clinicians who say there is no good reason for doing a breast exam on a 13-year-old girl other than for educational purposes. So we would seriously question what a doctor, particularly a male doctor, was doing, why on earth he would be doing breast examinations in the first place. It's not clinically justified. But as it turns out, what the Ministry of Children and Family Development is saying is that it is a matter of routine practice, that they obtain consent from the girls to do these overall health examinations. They're claiming it's in the best interest of the girls, and they are also claiming that they're looking for some obscure developmental disorder. The breast examinations are part of checking for some very obscure developmental disorder and or signs of self-harm. Now, we've looked into each of those. You know, we've talked to people who are experts in self-harm, and they say that's simply not justified. the doctors are telling us this is not justified. From a legal perspective, the court order that authorizes forensic psychiatric assessment, we've obtained a few legal perspectives on that from legal academics, and they're telling us it's simply not authorized by the court order that puts the girls there in the first place. And I think if you asked anybody on the street, is there any relevance of breast or gynecological health to a young woman's sentence? I think most people would say that's absurd and completely irrelevant. And I think most people would find it disturbing to know that that is what's going on in the prison. The Ministry of Children and Family Development is saying it's a matter of standard practice and that it's in the best interest of the girls. We entirely disagree. We see it as institutionally sexually abusive, and we don't believe that you can obtain consent in that context. It's essentially coerced. If you're there by court order for a psychiatric assessment, if your every move is observed for a period of, you know, let's say 5 days to a week, any refusal to participate in the process could affect your sentence negatively. For instance, you know, you could be written up as non-compliant, which has a direct impact on how young women are sentenced.
So they came up with sort of some bureaucratic reasons to bar you. Where has this gone in terms of, you know, how you're dealing with the situation now that you've been barred? And what's happening on the inside now in terms of that system?
I have to tell you, it's been extremely difficult for us as an organization to be barred from working with the girls. That was very difficult for us. Over the years, we've documented and responded to many human rights abuses within that prison, and so to know that the girls are there without any independent advocates. And the reason that Justice for Girls is able to do some pretty hard-hitting advocacy is we do not have any funding, and by policy we don't accept funding from the Ministry of Children and Family Development or any other government body that would hamper our advocacy. So I think, you know, we sort of feel like it's been years that they've probably hoped that they might find a reason to get us out of there. And so it's been very disturbing to us to think about the girls being in that prison without access to advocates who are going to go in and really, you know, name and challenge the human rights abuses that are going on. We've had contact with some of the young women once they've been released, so that's been a little reassuring for us, but it's been a long, hard battle with the Ministry of Children and Family Development. There are others involved. The Representative for Children and Youth's office has been involved, and the opposition critic has challenged them as well, but they're holding firm in their decision to keep us out.
So if people wanted to somehow you know, support you in advocating for your return into the prison, what types of things are you asking people to do?
Lots of people have written letters to the Minister of Children and Family Development, you know, stating, first off, that breast and gynecological examinations should not be conducted on teenage girls who are undergoing court-ordered psychiatric assessment. That is the first point, and the one that's most critical as far as we're concerned. And secondly, questioning the banning of independent advocates in the middle of a situation where the prison is under scrutiny, where an employee of the prison is being accused of sexual abuse. Whatever their excuse or justification, it has the look of being very clearly an attempt to suppress criticism and to suppress any revealing of abusive practices that are going on there.
Is that doctor still working there?
The doctor is still there. The doctor voluntarily stepped down for a period of, I think it was a week or so, and then was reinstated. His practice has been restricted, I believe, and I'm not sure whether this has changed or not, that he was not to be examining the girls. And we've tried to go about stopping the practice in a whole other way, because the prison is simply not listening to us. What we've done is written a letter and sent letters to the whole youth criminal bar. So the lawyers who represent young women, we've asked them to, first of all, not always agree to having girls undergo court-ordered psychiatric assessment. Usually it's done by consent, and we think it's overused to begin with. But secondly, if girls are going to be going to undergo psychiatric assessment, that the lawyers put on the record that they do not consent to any physical examination during that process, and to make sure that that young woman has a letter that states that she can present to the prison, and that the lawyers send a copy of a letter to the prison director saying, my client does not consent to any physical examination. From what I gather in talking to other people who deal with psychiatric assessments in the adult system, there's absolutely no reason to lay a hand at all on the person who's undergoing the psychiatric assessment. And the difference between psychiatric assessment in, for instance, a hospital setting versus in a forensic setting is that the forensic setting really narrows the scope. The law is actually designed to make that assessment very narrow, because it's recognized to be such an incursion into young women's, or well, youths, or anybody who's in that situation's, their privacy rights and security of the person. So it's meant to be very narrow. You have to understand that most of the girls that are doing time for things that are relatively minor, and that often those minor offenses wind up in incarceration because they have breached usually probation conditions or bail conditions that are unrealistic usually to begin with. So girls end up doing time for relatively minor and administrative offenses, and here they are in these prisons that are designed as max security prisons.
I have a quote here from the person who's running the youth prison, Kamal Khan. It says, this was released in the government press release that they put out when they, you know, talked about moving the youth to the new prison. It says, it is vital that while young people are in custody and under supervision, that they are given effective corrective support to promote lawful behavior, hence contributing to public safety. What's your response to that sort of mentality and that kind of language in terms of dealing with of young people?
Well, it sort of echoes, to me, it echoes a very conservative approach to youth crime and youth justice. You know, the idea that youth are a danger to the public, and this sort of, you know, moral panic that gets hyped up around the dangers of youth, I think is, you know, that statement is consistent with some of the other political movement that we see with the federal government, you know, kind of trying to clamp down a little harder on youth. And I mean, the irony of it, or the reality of it, is that Canada is harsher on youth than most countries in the Western world, and in fact is harder on youth than it is on adults for equivalent crimes. So the notion that we need to use this corrective force. In watching and in what goes on for young women there, and in visiting the prison on a regular basis, what I see is an institution that entirely dehumanizes the kids that are in it. And I don't see how any prison is going to improve the lives of young people or turn them into better citizens. Most of the girls that are in prison are there because of conditions of oppression, and to punish them for that is only to worsen their life circumstances.
And then I think if we look at the case of Ashley Smith, which was actually on the cover of the Globe and Mail on Saturday, mm-hmm. In her whole her story of starting out in the youth system and ending up in the adult system, and becoming more and more segregated and having increasing number of problems and mental health issues because of the conditions of incarceration. I think, you know, looking back, she was put in prison when she was 15. I don't know if you had any comments based on what you'd learned about that case or in terms of the connections of youth ending up in the system now and where that leads them.
There's no doubt in my mind that if you take a young person and you put them in a prison, if you take anybody and put them in a prison, I spend a few hours in that prison and feel demoralized and angry, that's my experience of being in there as an advocate, at knowing that I can get out again. So I try and imagine sometimes what that feels like to be in there and not be able to get out, and to be in there when you're also dealing with other extremely traumatic circumstances. You know, most of the girls that I know that have been in prison have been through horrendous experiences of violence, and so then to be put in a facility that dehumanizes you to the extent that a prison does, it's a wonder to me that any of them come out and are able to survive outside again. So I think if you want to break down a person, if you want to break down a young woman, put her in prison. And her life trajectory, if she's there for long enough, or if she's in and out of there enough, is going to be pretty dismal, because the prison is designed to dehumanize, and so it's not surprising to me that young women wind up in the adult system, and especially when they've experienced, like in the situation that we discovered with the forensic psychiatric assessment, what does that do to a young woman's head when she goes into prison? She's being punished for something. She's being told she's the bad person here. She's subjected to repeated strip searches. She is called by her last name. This might be because she's being charged with theft under, for instance, a minor property crime. And then she's subjected to a sexually abusive medical examination, and all the while the focus is on her as the bad person, and she's in the middle of that institution trying to make sense of this. I mean, it's very hard to make sense of it from the outside. It's, you know, we find ourselves consistently shocked by what goes on behind those walls, and that there's so little oversight as well. I mean, I think this is a huge problem, especially within the youth prisons, is that there are not many advocates who are independent. There are not many advocates at all, but it's... Without those eyes being on the prison, it's just ripe for abuse.
Does that fall through the cracks because it's run by the Minister of Children and Families, so it doesn't have the same sort of, maybe, the federal system has a bit more oversight, but is that another way that it falls through the cracks?
I can tell you, over the years I've been doing advocacy there, that the complaints procedures are a joke. So if you try and make a complaint against the prison, it's like beating your head against a wall. And the young women, I have to give them a load of credit for trying to make complaints against the prison, putting them in writing, submitting them formally. And they're usually dealt with in a way that doesn't follow much of a formal procedure. It's not a written response. We've challenged the prison many, many times on that. So the accountability is severely lacking.
So on top of oversight, what other things do you think need to happen, or what other ways to sort of promote positive change or alternatives do you think we need to put into place in our communities?
Well, I think we need to get girls out of prison, and I think there are lots of ways to do that. And usually the ways to do that start with dealing with the conditions that led them to be imprisoned in the first place. We'd like to see girls de-incarcerated altogether. We don't believe prison, you know, when girls have done something that's actually harmful or damaging to another person, usually it's other girls, but there are situations where they need to come out of their communities. But so I think we need to imagine a different way, and I think we need to come up with solutions instead of using prisons as a way to house girls or as a way to detox them or treat them for their addictions, because that's often what's happening. And it's often explicitly stated in the court. If you sit in youth court for very long, you hear these conversations amongst the lawyers and the judges, and it's pretty clear that girls are being housed in prison to deal with social problems that are not about criminal behavior at all, although sometimes it's a property crime or a drug offense or something that puts them there. But so I guess what we say is deal with the underlying conditions, deal with the poverty, deal with the devastating impact of colonization on the communities of Indigenous young women, deal with the violence that's being done to girls, because that's another reason girls wind up in prison, is that the prison is being used to quote-unquote protect them from violence on the street. Meanwhile, and we've monitored court cases where there's violence, where it's men being charged with violence against teenage girls versus where girls are being charged with some, you know, petty crime. And if you look at, for instance, just the difference in conditions on a probation order between those two, where you might have a guy who's actually got a criminal history of violence versus the young woman who's done a property crime, I can guarantee you that she will probably have 20 conditions on her probation order, and he may have 5. So this is a terrible disparity in the way the justice system works. So often the girls are being criminalized in order to get them off the street where they're being exploited and abused. And so we say, well, deal with the exploitation and abuse. You know, go after the abusers. Stop locking up girls in prison in order to keep them safe. You're not keeping them safe. They're in danger in prison. You know, it's a damaging place for girls for all kinds of reasons. So, you know, get to the underlying conditions, but we want to find an alternate to prison. I mean, hopefully, if we start to look at why girls wind up in prison and deal with those things, that they won't be there at all. And there are other countries, for instance, England has de-incarcerated young women. And I think Canada always sort of prides itself on being this great upholder of human rights, and everybody imagines youth prisons as being these kind of day camps for teenagers, and it's very cushy there, and it's very soft on youth. And in fact, the opposite is true. Canada is not a great upholder of human rights at all. I think we realize that. And youth prisons are prisons. They look like prisons. They have razor wire. They're not nice places. It is not a cushy place for kids to be. And the young women that I know are not, you know, these incredibly system-wise kids who know how to deke around the criminal justice system. They're not. Half the time, the criminal justice system is steamrolling them, and they are trying to just be involved in the process. We do a lot of work to try and teach young women how to take some control in the process, even just how to instruct a lawyer. So, you know, I think we need to get over that notion in a hurry and recognize the reality of prisons for girls and for boys, for that matter.